Well, hi and welcome. I hope you're all doing great and are poised for a terrific holiday week, those of you in the U.S. Especially, but for everybody, for a great week. Thanks again for the questions, the comments that you've sent in. We're going to have a discussion today that's a little bit more directly related to coaching and more away from theory to its application about mind-brain performance sciences. And we're going to talk about applying that in terms of working with clients and mindset mapping and some principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. So I think this will be a more practical application. And let me address one specific question that I don't think we've addressed yet. It was from Brittany about what is the single most effective approach or method to strategic change? And that would be, can I get a mute on the background noise? I hear somebody breathing. I hear you doing some paper wrestling or some things in the background. If you would mute star six until you're ready to talk or ask a question or add something. I want to keep an open mic for our discussion. And I want to address in a beginning way this question and then ask if you have other comments or questions at this point. A practical application from what we've talked about is to ask a question, because when you ask a question, you're not giving a fact or data or information for somebody to, or a belief for somebody to compare if they believe it or not, or share that view. If they do, they'll find ways to confirm it. If they don't, to refute it. But you're asking a question which immediately frames it as a collaboration, that you're both together looking at the same thing. And I've had, you know, coaches who have trained with me who have said, you know, this is just a really different idea, and it's had the major impact for me of talking to my adolescents. I say, you mean asking them what they think or feel instead of telling them? Yeah, that's it exactly. So the principle is to engage someone to explore together from their point of reference. And that's why we ask the client in the beginning, for example, what would you like us to focus on? And then secondly, where would you like us to get to? Because we are then co-creating a system for someone with the client's point of reference and story to develop that. Now, a micro system is the coaching story of that session. The macro system may be something at one level of the whole coaching engagement, or it may be, as we've begun to discuss, a systematic way of looking at understanding the algorithms of how someone operates, behavior, thinking, a number of things, and we'll come to that. So looking at a system, and in the simplest terms, when you ask a client what the client wants to focus on, where they want to get to, you're creating a map. That map is a beginning for that discussion, for that session, and it's something that a client can download while you're talking about other things. You have a systematic way to focus on something and look at a destination and a way to collaboratively, successively approximate that destination so that in that conversation, if it's 15 or 20 minutes, if it's a 45 or 50-minute session, you've collaboratively created a map and a way of developing the client's story for that period of time. So that, and we'll talk more about what we listen for in the process as we go along. So I wanted to just give a heads up to begin to address that question. And again, thanks for all the responses that you've sent in, the questions, the discussion, and I welcome that. And it helped me so much last time that I heard that I departed enough from the outline that it was hard to follow. So I'll get back with it and stick a bit more to the outline so you'll be able to track that. So any thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to add or ask before we officially start? Anyone? Anything you want to add to what you'd like us to cover in our remaining two times based on what you've seen and the kind of questions maybe that have arisen as you've listened and looked at the material?
David, may I?
Go for it. Yes, I was getting lonely there. Go ahead.
Awesome. My name is Nathalie. Thank you. In the last seminar, you mentioned that our identity controls our choices. Personally, I thought it was our value. Can you please tell us more about it?
Well, identity is the bedrock of how and who someone is, including their internal operating system. And identity actually has a location in the brain. Our sense of self has a specific location in the brain, and our identity is based on our sense of needs and ideals that we synthesize into an idea of how and who we are and how we operate, how well it works. So purpose is important in terms of looking at an application of what we do and a planning for what we do. That's often what we engage in coaching. So our identity is that bedrock of how and who we see ourselves, because we're always going to be loyal to that identity. Let me give you a couple of brief examples. And I've touched on this before. If you, neuroeconomists tell us this, if you show 10 people 10 different items, you can predict with over 95% accuracy, if they're given the choice of purchasing one of those 10 items, you can predict which one it'll be, because it's the one that they identify with, the one that they see as most like themselves. So that's really important in terms of helping someone create a way of seeing themselves that fits with their story, whether that's a life story, a wellness story. Here's another simpler example. The easiest way, for example, and there has been some very sophisticated research that's going to sound very unsophisticated as I summarize it, that the very easiest way to go about structuring working out every day, and this began with a colleague of mine that I'm familiar with his work, Henry Lodge Jr., in his book Younger Next Year, if you treat working out as part of a structure of what you do, like going to work. You don't get up every day when you go to work and debate about whether you're going to do it, or feel virtuous if you do it, or bargain with yourself to say, well, I'm going to knock off this week. I'll really get with it next week. No, it's part of who you are. It's what you do. It's how you see yourself. You see yourself as a parent, as a coach, as a professor, whatever you – if you don't work out, it doesn't feel right, because you violated your sense of self, because that's who you are. You work out every day. Now, this is after it happens for a while, so you don't have to be motivated in order to work out. You just have to have a plan and stick to it. That's where we come in as coaches. Somebody doesn't need to be motivated to do whatever they do. They just need a plan and to stick to it. If you wait for motivation, that's a limiting assumption. If you wait for inspiration, that, as well as waiting to feel comfortable or confident, those are all limiting expectations. And if you stop yourself until that happens, it ain't going to happen. So this is a part of, for example, here's a part of that that can be applied. And think about this, if any of you do any face-to-face. There were a large number of patients studied in about, let's see, five different large physician practices. They were given, half of them were given the card for the return visit. where the receptionist wrote the time and the date, gave it to the patient. The other half, the patient was asked to write it down himself or herself and to say it to the receptionist. The ones who wrote it down, 18% greater show rate, 18% less no-show, because they wanted to be consistent with how they saw themselves and what they had committed to in writing and out loud. So that puts it in an output channel to start with, but it also, it's a part of identity. So identity is one of the things that I want to look at the components of identity. One of the first things I do often with mentor coaching clients is to ask them, I send them two exercises that they pick their three top needs and their top three ideals. And that's a bedrock of identity. So that's helpful to me for both of us. And often it's helpful for the client because sometimes their strategies or what they're doing may not fit with that bedrock of their needs and their ideals, basically components of their identity. So when they're clear about that and strategies and goals fit with that, all of them is going in the same direction, and it feels way better and is way more successful. Now, that was way too many words, but does that make sense to simply answer your question in a simpler way? It's who we are and how we see ourselves to be. So this is something we need to be aware of as coaches, because if someone just changes something they do, they change a behavior without changing the underlying identity or operating system, they're going to revert back. So we want to help them transform what they're doing as part of their new operating system, their new story of how and who they are, so that they can make it permanent and ultimately the same default mode as driving to work every day when they can listen to a book and not have to think about it. So does that make sense for that? And I know you sent in that question, and I'm glad you mentioned it. Does that make sense for right now, at least?
Yes, thank you very much for enlightening me. And I'm guessing that our values is part of the bedrock of what makes our identity then, isn't it?
Yes, the values, the same as ideals. And they're very related and almost the same. You know, for a practical example, the failure to live up to an internal ideal results in shame. Now, you assume that ideal is attainable and reasonable, but the failure to live up to an internal ideal results in shame. Guilt is when you transgress a sense of right or wrong or what you should or ought or might do. That's different. So, and the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having attainable ideals and living up to them. And anything that self comes in front of, think of all the things you think of, you know, identity, esteem, everything that self comes in front of, control, that is all part of an internal ideal and part of identity. So this is what we're listening for also with our clients, because that sometimes may not be as clear. Their needs and their ideals may not be quite as clear to them as it may sound like it is. So thank you for that, and we can circle back to that if there are follow-up questions. I'm going to move to a lecture mode, so you can go ahead with that full-fledged cough in just a second. Hold on.
Thank you.
Okay, we're in presentation mode, so you don't have to worry about the background noise. We are talking in this seminar about mindset mapping for growth. This is a practical application of some of the things we've talked about in the first two seminars. And as a sidebar here, remember when you talk to clients, you're having a conversation, a contingent conversation that is based on the client as point of reference, developing the story from where the client is now. What we're talking about now is at a different level. I don't talk to clients the way I'm talking to you. This is about training and using some ideas, bringing together some things so that you can shape it into your own working concept, your own professional identity, and into the conversation that will seem natural and fluid with your clients. So, recall from last seminar, we talked about a state of mind being like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we then process it, and how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, and what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. And this is what we, between the first couple of questions that we ask a client, what would you like us to focus on? And where would you like us to get to? That's the map determined by the client. And before we get to the end of the session, in the last couple of minutes, and ask the client, what's the most important thing you're taking away today so that they're summarizing for themselves to make it part of their operating system? And then based on that, what do you commit to do? Everything in the middle between those two questions, the vast majority of the session is jazz. That's the co-creation of the story with the client developing this. So this is something that we're listening for to see what facilitates and what interferes with that story. If a client, as I mentioned a few moments ago, has a limiting assumption or an assumption that's not working or a bias or a blind spot, then that's why, in my view, I've asked permission from the very beginning with every client, may I interrupt you at a point if I think it would be helpful for us to look at this together, and then give them permission, certainly, to do the same with me, because if I say something that doesn't make sense, I want to know it right there so we're back on track, so we're leapfrogging along. So mindsets frame an ongoing account of how we interpret, process, and what we do. Mindsets are powerful beliefs. They're the stories we have about ourselves and about anything we do in the world. An example, researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the physical world. In other words, the brain operates like a Google map. So it's not just one big continuous flow. The brain makes a whole series of maps to navigate. That's why we need a story and to see the continuity of all of that. And that story is based on our needs and our ideals on the bedrock of identity. So when a new situation arises, a new map is booted up. This explains how we have different context or frames for different situations. So how you frame something determines the map you boot up to deal with it. So here's a very simple example. A client begins with you deciding to focus on something, you've agreed on that, and the client then says, well, here's the problem that I've always had about that. So immediately, the client brings closure so that nothing new is explored. They go back to what they're familiar with. So that's where I would interrupt, because that problem framework, even with exploration and creating new solutions, is going to etch that pathway further in the client's brain. It's going to be easier to do it. There's going to be a catharsis. Think about last time you were on the patio having a glass of Chardonnay with your buddies. How long did it take for people to start talking about problems or situations that were narrow escape, things that they already know? So at that moment, I would exercise, in this example, the interruption to say, you know, I hear how you framed it as a problem, or simply just to say, let's look at the opportunity here, the challenge. Because at that juncture, in that person's brain, the most likely scenario is there's some trigger of anxiety or uncertainty with a half stutter step into new territory, something the client has not experienced or doesn't know quite what to do, and boom, they bring closure and immediate comfort, no cognitive dissonance by going back to the problem. Now, it doesn't solve anything, but it kind of creates a catharsis. There's a relief for a while, but at that juncture, that's where you can stay with a client to look at what's possible. That's the juncture I mentioned earlier, that anxiety and excitement registers as exactly the same in the brain. If you're more familiar with anxiety, you boot up the problem mindset or the avoidance. If you stay with the excitement, you can look at possibility, at new ways of thinking and feeling and beginning to create new pathways in the brain. But it's not as easy because you don't know where it's going to end up. It's unfamiliar. So this is what we have to appreciate with a client, that every step into the new and different and not experienced will result in some signal of this is not quite right. The error detection mechanism, this is not what I expected, and a discomfort because they don't know exactly how it's going to turn out. So this is where we really have to empathically resonate with a client and really get how different it is for them to proceed in this way. So the mindsets or the maps are stored in our hippocampus, the brain's memory focal point. A mindset is its own world, its own software system, complete and internally consistent. The mindset comes first. You frame it as anxiety or excitement in this example. And then that state of mind determines the meaning you attach, just like a software program on a computer. You boot up, Microsoft Word. You have a whole system of software that you develop. If you boot up a financial program, QuickBooks, a whole different system, and only what will be input by that system is accepted. So it determines what you perceive, how you process it. So let's look at mind maps a little bit more closely. This is the brain story. The mind map, the brain connections, influence the reality that we see. A paradigm that's roughly synonymous with the mindset, it's a model, the theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our particular way of seeing things, our individual paradigm or map. Now, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference, like reframing as challenge or opportunity to look at the excitement of it, and then with that framework, what can be a way to proceed? Here's an example of the difference that can make. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The two anthropologists lived, each of them, in the as identical as possible ape colonies, not communicating with each other, lived for a year and then emerged to compare results. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony. He achieved a remarkable harmony and unity and comfort with the apes. Got remarkable data. The other anthropologist did not have that experience. He never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He was always careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that harmony and comfort. Now, the anthropologist were so similar themselves. They did not understand why the results were so discrepant, or they couldn't find any reason. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. His framework was he knew if things got tough, he had an out. The other anthropologist had no gun but had a commitment. He knew from the beginning he would either make it or not on his own. Two different mindsets, two remarkably different experiences and outcomes. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions and mindsets created the reality they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. So a belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. If you want to hear somebody's belief about something, just simply ask, well, how do you know? And as coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs that ghostwrite behaviors. So a map reduces the size and complexity of a territory. It creates a system, like we talked about the coaching conversation. So this can be very effective. Rather than each situation being overwhelming or chaotic or a new experience, we look at booting up a map for this situation, of creating a system with the client that they can take with them and use or adapt to a novel situation. So the danger is that we place the new into the container of the known, the old software or the old plan into a current where that could prevent new learning. So one of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness. This is what we develop with clients. They help them develop self-reflection, self-awareness, and with that, self-regulation and management of emotion. This is huge. Having this ability, we can learn from our own experiences and from others. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or thoughts. We can think about these things, reflect on them, and then examine our paradigms to see if they work or if they need to be revised. So this is important in looking at and listening with a client at how they're constructing their story. And a simple example, if you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. Simply, if you feel bad saying no to someone when they ask you to do something or to whatever, if you say no and then label that feeling as guilt, you're going to be using a very different map than if you see it as setting an appropriate boundary of taking care of yourself and assessing that this is not for me at this time. I need to stay with my story instead of saying yes to yours. You're taking care of yourself. It's a very different way of proceeding if you're taking care of yourself than if you're dealing with guilt. Roy Menninger said, very simply, save guilt for real sin. So here's another example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be an executor of my estate. And his daughter, my client, said, well, sure, Dad, I'll be happy to. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and your wishes. And he looked at her and said, that's none of your business. That's a conflicting mindset. Remember, the map is not the territory. That is, our beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities we each experience. So as we recognize we each create our own stories, to take ownership of those stories in order to assess what needs to change, what needs to be enhanced, or ignored. To say that a different way, whatever you think and feel and experience, you're creating each moment. Whatever you experience, you're either creating or agreeing to, which is an active process as well. So to map a new story and navigate, let's revisit that notion of the brain's error detection mechanism. Discomfort and uncertainty began any significant journey from the first step. Our brains have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says, this isn't normal when we try something new. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, those patterns become hardwired and automatic. Then, if something is different, we notice that it doesn't fit a predicted pattern. In other words, it activates that part of the brain. And usually that registers as, this isn't right. Now, that can be misread as, well, my gut's telling me this is not right for me, or my intuition says this is not the right choice. There is intuition, there is gut feelings, but this is error detection mechanism that we're talking about. The error detection mechanism functions to compare input, new experiences, what you're seeing, feeling, with what's expected. And a mismatch gives a signal that there's a disruption in the order of things. So this error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmation. Think about how easier it is to focus on the things that we do wrong or the problems we have while we struggle to list our strengths. Or if advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before they ever consider it. Another reason that we're not nearly as effective in giving advice or ideas to someone, or in any way suggesting what they do. This is another barrier to resist change. Telling a client what to do or what you've done may trigger the error detection mechanism. Focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. So think back to that conversation on the patio with a glass of Chardonnay. The mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, such as stress or childhood, may not apply in a current situation. But the hardwiring is not permanent. It can be revised. This is our job description. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, such as collaborative contingent conversations, this is what we do in coaching, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as a part of a powerful internal navigation system. So I want to look with you right now, and this is in your outline. I just want to elaborate a bit. There are 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. Now, again, you're not talking like this to a client, but this is for your information to synthesize and integrate into how you listen and respond in a contingent conversation with another real person. This is not training, what we're talking about as a way of talking. This is us talking, okay? One, change creates discomfort. Part of the reason for a resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation and to make routine behaviors easy. And this is the example I gave. After we do it for a month or so, we don't have to think about the way we drive to work every day. This is the default mode. It's on autopilot, so we can listen to a book, for example. It's very energy efficient because the brain's freed up to do other things. When these habits are confronted and have to change, the autopilot in the midbrain gets disrupted. We feel discomfort. And the prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process it in a somewhat different way. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit, to foreclose consideration and move to the default habit, never mind that it has a glass ceiling, never mind that it doesn't work. There's an instant relief in doing it. It's kind of like not thinking past the first three bites of that cheesecake, especially with strawberry topping. So the brain naturally resists change. To hardwire behavior saves energy, so it's been adaptive from an evolutionary standpoint. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. In fact, beliefs can turn genes off or turn them on. And I heard him say this in person, and this is a quote from Ray Kurzweil in The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. This is how he put it, very succinctly. It would take me 7.5 minutes to say this. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, George Costanza, said, I like things you don't have to think about. They're together on this. Two, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, we don't see what we don't expect. The brain's error mechanism reads as if something's wrong, so we dismiss it. So, since this portion of your brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors, consider the emotional expense, the cognitive strain of two things. A lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance, triple work. This is also why when a lie is repeated enough, it rewires the brain so somebody doesn't even recognize it as a lie. And on sensitive testing, a lie detector, it's not even picked up as a lie. And the second, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that you have to pay more for it. Then, at the same time, the emotional expense, the dissonance in your brain, your error detection mechanism, recognizes that you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay the interest on the debt, triple work. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we respond to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and print out to change itself. It's not your intuition that comes from your error detection mechanism. We'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. Three, and again, you can track this in your outline. The brain is a prediction machine. Here's what I'd like you to do. Take a pen or pencil and a sheet of paper. I'd like you to write down some numbers. Here are the numbers to write down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. Think about this for just a second. Look at those numbers. What's missing? Maybe you've said 3 and 6. Maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. Let's say a stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts that a 3rd rise will follow. J. Paul Getty put this very simply. He said that there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So this is the basis of a number of jokes. Two things and then a non-sequitur is third. Setup, setup, payoff. You can see how the brain predicts patterns as the basis of creating expectations and repeated events. This is a challenge to override at times both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. That's a whole aspect itself which we need to be familiar with as coaches, is the entire realm of decision neuroscience. More on that. Four, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy on employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither one. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short-term, but they actually draw attention, you get what you focus on, away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior, and recognition for someone being on time actually creates anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. It focuses on lateness and whether you're on time or not. So we assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's neural homeostasis says, avoid change. This is also why you charge big money for coaching, because this is your specialty of looking at choice architecture of how to help someone change, even when their brain doesn't want them to. Who are you going to ask? A coach, okay? Five, motivation is not essential. I've already basically summarized this, that in many of the professional athletes and actors I've worked with, get up in the morning, go to the gym. They're not motivated to go to the gym, but they do every day because that's what they need to do. That's part of their plan. They have a system and then part of our identity. Motivation isn't essential, but a plan and sticking to it are. This is where you come in coaching. A plan, a system, and sticking to it. For example, you don't have to be motivated, say, for retirement. You just set up an automatic payment or a participation plan. You only make a good choice one time. You decide to transfer, set up a system to transfer $200 first day of every month to your retirement account. You don't have to think about it again. Six, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline especially, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk usually comes from a time capsule or isn't very effective. In fact, this was put very simply by another 20th century philosopher, Mike Tyson. He said, everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth. So this is why we want to especially be aware of ways, of systematic ways of self-regulation and reflection, of ways to develop a plan. So this is important as we work with clients. Seven, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short-term, but enhance learning. Now, this time window is only about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, stress can head things in the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So this means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. So this is the most important success strategy for many of the executives I've worked with, the regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. I think it's essential for everyone, and it will be an issue, I'll bet, with every one of your clients if you think about how can you help them regulate a state of mind and get to a balanced, grounded state to be able to have access to all the information in all of their states of mind, all of their software. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, particularly exclusively, like a specific business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. For example, a place that I see this kind of resistance, even at times entrenchment, in mentor coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone is needing to change roles, relationships, and even identity. And there's a whole program in place about how the things have always been done. And it's not just in the management suite, it's in the brains of each of the people who have a say in it. Now, these last two principles, I think, are huge. 9, neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells, is brought about by two things. Enhanced environment. Let me say that a little bit differently, because this is exactly what we do. Enriched environment, because that's the challenge of reflection and the thinking. Enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust. The basic job description of what we do in coaching. Now, here's what's happening in the brain. The hippocampus, part of the midbrain, is especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Now, what's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100%. It almost doubles with regular exercise. And this has been replicated in humans, in non-invasive studies to show essentially the same findings. It's been done in University of Hamburg medical students and London taxicab drivers. Another finding, again, the hippocampus, the site of intellectual and memory, of creativity and memory especially, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. So with chronic stress, the hippocampus, creativity and memory, decreases the number of cells. And 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This is what we do in coaching. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning, and developing cortical real estate. Here's an illustration of how when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. You've probably heard of this is a prototype study. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment where they had headgear with a visual apparatus that reversed everything, turned everything upside down, consistently 24 hours a day. So up was down, down was up. So every time they made any kind of move, they had to very carefully think about it, adjust everything they did in order to navigate. Then, about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustment. Their brains rewired. They didn't have to think it through anymore. The brains developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off. They were out of the helmet for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. So note the role of consistency here. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing attribution of meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. when our predictions get repeatedly confirmed, the patterns become automatic, so we don't even have to think about them. Patterns become hardwired. So a final thing I want to review with you, how to think about mapping change. There are six crucial elements to map change. So I want to talk just a brief overview as we conclude about how to understand and incorporate each of these six. One, regulate states of mind. We've already discussed how states of mind, each state of mind is like a software program. They're a mind-body state that determines, like software, how we perceive and process information. So a key element is first to get grounded and centered so that we can choose the optimum state to deal with something. It's simple, a kind of a goofy but simple example. If you're writing, to create something new and different is a very different state of mind than editing. So you don't want to mix the two and go back and forth. Look at how to align with your algorithms, your creative time, to do that in your most creative hour during the day, and how to edit when you don't have to use that same creativity or the openness like when you're on an airplane. But that's just a personal example here. So when someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right-varying response, the feeling brain. So in extreme stress, the emotional brain can hijack the intellectual logical brain and even hold it hostage. So what do? Your brain's working against you. When you're in any state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate experience and feeling to restore a cool state, a balance of left and right brain. So the brain equation for good decisions, the right brain, this is oversimplified, the right brain, the emotional brain, balanced with the left brain, logical and intellectual, is a balanced decision. And we can talk about that more about, instinct and response and how those two need to be integrated. The number two element to map change, the power is in the focus. This is neuroscience and quantum physics applied to the law of attraction. The energy field of your brain, thoughts have a frequency and energy field. Focus selects that frequency. It's like all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. You choose the channel. You choose the frequency you want out of hundreds of possibilities. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the focus of what you do, your thoughts. Now, the bad news here is if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over because your brain doesn't know, your unconscious especially, doesn't know the difference between negative and positive, just the focus. So that means you want to focus on the right things. Put energy into what you want. Focus on possibility instead of problems, to extend the example we talked about earlier. Desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it, to add energy to it. This creates resistance. It's a focus. But when you focus on what you don't want falls away. It's kind of like your lap when you get up to walk. Three, visualize changes. Visualization aligns the energy field, the brain. I think there's a chapter from one of my books in your work pages about visualization. So I want to look at our last couple or three things and then have just a little bit of time for questions. Insight changes the brain. A moment of insight, an aha experience. If you hook your client up, for example, with an fMRI scan, and they have a moment of insight, an aha moment, three different parts of their brain lights up, and they're vaulted into a state of mind that's more synthetic and integrative and creative. So it trumps any uncertainty or anxiety about change. Now, at the same time they're thinking about something, they're given facts or data or options or opinions, no part of the brain lights up. So as important as insight-induced change is, the sustained attention and systematic development of it is what hardwires it. 5, take action. The world is not going to pay you for what you know or what you think or what your intention is. It's going to pay you for what you do. It rewards action. Now, to analyze and plan are hugely important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it in motion. It may not be perfect, but they self-correct and keep moving forward, learning from mistakes, producing results. This is why a group, maybe of the brightest people anywhere, with all kind of degrees, can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. I know those groups. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished community college the second semester owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And finally, 6, transform identity. We've talked about this. New experience or idea needs to be focused on consistently and frequently and incorporated into an evolving and transforming operating model of how and who you are. Otherwise, just with change, it will stand alone. It'll be one and done, a kind of not me experience. So this is why a vision, when you visualize something, needs to include the experience, the feeling of achieving it. So when you inhabit the entire episode, you make it part of your self-experience. And this is also why we do what we do, because of how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So here's a summary. I think this is in your outline too. Here are the specific simple principles in bullet form to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior. 1, begin where the client is. 2, help them learn about what they already know, because that's where they are going to be anyhow, and if you tell them something new and different, they're going to be even more entrenched in what they know. Highlight positive attributes. It's a part of framing. The existing neuronal networks, natural talents, behaviors, and patterns that work to enhance the choice of that in their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Remember, focus enhances neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. Encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors, those are maps. When a client creates them, they take ownership and experience mastery. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations and connections. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences themselves. When we write a new story and change our minds, we also change our brains. So, give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. We're in discussion mode, not as much time as I'd hope, but any clarifications or questions about anything we've talked about so far? Is this making sense to you? And it seems, as you let it marinate, useful and adaptive for what you're doing in your coaching practice.
David, Natalie here.
Go home.
I just want to say thank you so much. It was so very enlightening. Thank you so much for answering my question in such depth. I'm very impressed, and I really love this seminar session today. It was very enlightening and very interesting. Thank you so much.
Well, absolutely, and thank you all again for giving me the ideas and the clarification of what would be most useful to you and how you'd like to apply it. I'm kind of synthesizing that into some of what I'm talking about and trying to stick as much as possible to the outline. So, anything else you'd like to add or ask? We've got just a minute. I want to respect the time. Well, thank you all very much, and we will pick up right here next time for our final seminar. If there are any questions or things you'd like to be sure and cover, fire an email to me. So thanks very much. Have a great week and a great holiday. here in the U.S., and a great week everywhere. Thank you all very much. I look forward to picking up with you next time. I appreciate your responses. Bye now.
Thank you.
Thank you.